Okay, I've laid out for you on the organization. You'll see that the way the Lutherans are organized, they have a pastor and these lay officers that they call elders, and then they also have trustees. So there's a couple of names in there you don't find in the Bible anywhere, or at least one. And then it's the Presbyterian style of organization, so they have these conferences that they get together, synods, on a district level, and then they'll have district synods that are united in a general synod. And the Lutherans themselves, the church is about, I guess it's still the third largest grouping of Christian, quote, Christians in the world. A lot of them are in Germany, as you might imagine, with it being in view of where the Lutheran Church started. It got brought to America in the 17th century, and the first congregation was met in New York, which was then New Amsterdam, in 1649, and at that time the churches were small, and they really didn't have any preachers. As time went on, though, these congregations, with immigration coming along, the congregations grew, the number of congregations grew, and so you had various scattered groups that would eventually form a synod, and by the 1800s, you had 20 or so of these bodies that were meeting as synods, and eventually, or this basically was the core group that would evolve into what's known as the American Lutheran Church with time, and the Lutheran Church in America with time. So you see this, like the states grew with time in the 1800s, you had with immigration, you had a rapid growth of the Lutheran Church as well. I've listed for you under D, just really for reference, a number during this period of time, a number of these churches that existed, and they would merge, and you have to have a map or a program to tell the players. There's so many of them, and they would continually be changing as time went on. Ultimately, it boils down in this country to three main groups of Lutherans you might run into. The first is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. This branch of the Lutheran Church is what you consider liberal on a scale. These three, one goes from liberal and the other one to the most conservative of the three. And this one was made up of the American Lutheran Church and Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches and then the Lutheran Church in America in 1982. So it's relatively, as a single group, it's relatively new. They meet every couple of years in a general synod, and they are... as I say, very liberal and very ecumenical, and they participate in a number of different dimensions of that, and I'll hit on one of them in just a moment. Remember we talked about Luther and how Luther believed in education, both spiritual and secular education. Well, that follows through on the Lutheran organization. Is it me or go hide as well? Time I come in here, I have to turn the thing down. And so you may be familiar with some of these, maybe run across them in your lifetime. They've got something like 8 seminaries and a couple of extension centers and deaconesses communities and 28 colleges and universities that they run. 14 high schools, 300 elementary schools, and a bunch of early child programs. So they're very active in the Lutheran Church, very active in education. The ELCA is part of what's called the Lutheran World Federation. And they were participants in something that was referred to as a meeting, which produced something referred to as a joint declaration on the doctrine of justification back in 99. And the reason I want to bring that up, not only were the representatives there from the Lutheran World Federation, but you had the Catholic Church represented there. And they produced this product, the joint declaration, as a product. Now, you know, we know our history on how Luther stood up against the Catholic Church and how the Lutheran group started. Well, here's what they, two of the comments or excerpts out of this joint declaration. The understanding of the doctrine of justification set forth in this declaration shows that a consensus in basic truths of the doctrine of justification exists between Lutherans and Catholics. Therefore, the Lutheran and Catholic explications of justification are in their difference open to one another and do not destroy the consensus regarding the basic truth. I've got a note in my margin that says this is basically, I call this fluff, sort of covers all bases sort of fluff. And they went on to say in another paragraph, the teaching of the Lutheran churches represented in this declaration does not fall under the condemnations from the Council of Trent. The condemnations in the Lutheran confessions do not apply to the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church presented in the in this declaration. So, you know, basically, they agree to not argue with one another and to work, you know, if they're not working together today, they will in time. You know, that's where this would be going. The second group, and one that you may be more familiar with, hear more about, is the Lutheran Church, the Missouri Synod. And they're on the scale, they're sort of in the middle as far as their conservatism. They will make this point about their theology. Being Lutheran, our congregations accept and teach Bible-based teachings of Martin Luther, the inspired reformation of the Christian church in the 16th century. The teaching of Luther and the reformers can be summarized in three short phrases: grace alone, scripture alone, faith alone. The congregations in the synod are what they call confessional. They follow the Augsburg Confession and the two catechisms we talked about, and a number of the creeds and a number of other things. And this is all rolled up in a almost 500-page book called the Book of Concord that covers all that. And that is their what they base their beliefs on. That's their creed, basically. There are differences between this and the previous one I talked about, substantial, really. They point out the degree of liberalism within the Lutherans, between what you'd call liberal and not so liberal. The ECLA avoids, the LCMS believes that the Bible is without error in all that it says. The ECLA avoids making such statements, holding that Scripture is not necessarily always accurate on such matters as history and science. Inerrancy? It's got errors in it. It's kind of the two approaches. The ECLA, while affirming commitment to the gospel of Jesus Christ as witnessed to in the Lutheran confessional writings, tends to emphasize historical character of these writings to maintain the possibility of dissent to confessional positions that do not deal directly with the gospel itself. And so they said, you know, we'll take it. And kind of their view, I'd say, is sort of take it or leave it. It depends on whether we like it or not, whether we accept it. And then this one really struck me, the level of agreement necessary to join together in one church body within the LCMS it requires agreement in all that the Bible teaches. Now, I don't know how strongly they promote that. There's not a body of people anywhere in the world, I guess, if the number's two or more, that they agree on everything. And yet that seems to be a condition for membership, and I'm sure that resolves down to some fundamental issues they have. Whereas the ECLA holds a disagreement in some matters of doctrine, such as the mode of Christ's presence in Holy Communion, do not prohibit church fellowship. Remember, Lutherans are believers in consubstantiation. And what this is really, I think, saying is, well, if you don't believe in that, that's all right. Come join us anyway. Okay? So, you know, you wonder how strong their belief systems, their faith really is, even in what they claim to be their beliefs. The Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod is the most conservative of the bunch. It's not ecumenical, but it's relatively small. I doubt you'd ever run into it. They make a statement that, though, that I thought was worth repeating. The teachings of the Lutheran Church are those of the original ancient church of the apostles and early Christians. And this is not unusual. I mean, you go probably to any of these denominations, and they're going to basically say the same kind of thing. Just substitute whatever the denomination is. I mentioned the Lutheran Federation, World Federation. They are involved in co-sponsoring all kinds of bilateral dialogues. They've had them with the Anglicans, the Orthodox Churches, Roman Catholic Church, World Alliance of Reformed Churches, World Methodist Council, Baptist World Alliance, Seventh-day Adventist. So they're very, you know, that collectivity of Lutherans that operates under the auspices of the LWF, very, very ecumenical. And, you know, I guess the fundamental issue is, if you believe anything about Jesus, then you're our friend. We can associate with you. We can do things with you. We can work with you on matters of on religious matters.
Well, ecumenical is that a fairly new concept or term? I don't remember hearing that term growing up.
Really?
Whereas, you know, most different faiths.
To answer your question is yes, it is relatively new.
Okay. So it's on the news more now versus what
it
used to be.
Yeah. I mean, you know, basically, to a large extent, religions, the denominations, and you know, we've talked about the variety, but to a large extent, they've become more social organizations. And so the fact that you might believe one thing, you might believe something else, doesn't prevent us from associating together and doing something social. You know, social being can be in service. It's not just, you know, having donuts and coffee, but it can be in service. But they can work hand in hand. Yeah, Greg.
I don't know about the Danish or the Southern European group, but I know with the Germans in America and the immigrations to Pennsylvania, Ohio, and later to the southern states, they were communities. And you were a part of that Lutheran church that was the center of that community. And they, you know, married other Germans, they spoke the same language, yeah, they believed the same things. And so they had that solidification until time went on and time progressed and they started to integrate more into the people. So it was more of a social thing, I think, even though they had a religious background, I think a lot of it was social.
Religion in early America, in these communities, pervaded all aspects of life. That's true. And it wasn't the cosmopolitan kind of fair situation we have now, or maybe that's not the right word, but the vast differences that exist. Okay. Lesson 17. It's really the Reformed and Presbyterian churches that we're going to talk about are out of the same general background. They have some aspects of their development that would separate and start to take a parallel path with time. we've got our old friend. We've had Luther over in Germany, and now we've got our friend who wasn't exactly in agreement with Luther and all things, Mr. Zwingli. We're not going to go through and relive his life. Just recall that he took the position that things in religion were only authorized if they were in the Bible. Luther, they were only you could do anything as long as it wasn't restricted by the Bible. So silence, in one case, silence allowed anything. In the other case, silence didn't permit anything. Zwingli also, and Luther had this big conflict on consubstantiation. Zwingli did not accept consubstantiation. Luther did. So as the Reformed and Presbyterian churches would develop, they do not, generally speaking, do not follow consubstantiation. As a belief. Zwingli, of course, as he moved into Switzerland, ended up eventually in Geneva, and ended up making contact with Calvin. And so we talked about Calvin at length, talked about Calvin for 3 months practically in Sam's class, or at least his theology. And so we don't need to cover that to any degree. Calvin, the only point to be made about Calvin is his influence in Geneva would produce out of that the Reformed churches of Europe in Switzerland, Germany, and Holland, the Dutch Reformed. And then Presbyterians in Scotland and Great Britain, and the Huguenots. I don't think we've talked about the Huguenots. In France, the Huguenots were Protestants, members of the Reformed Church that was in France, and started by Calvin. They were persecuted, greatly persecuted, and as a result of that, they would disperse, ended up dispersing, going to different countries, different areas. They were, as a group, artisans. They had craftsmen and professional people in them. And so it turned out wherever they went, they were, if there wasn't religious persecution, they were well received because of their talents. And they ended up heading over largely in the Carolinas, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York areas of the colonies and set up shop and the Reformed Church, as a result of that, grows up in the Americas in that area. At the same time, Presbyterianism, like Congregationalism, had its roots to a large part in the Puritan movement within the Church of England. There was an activity that went on in the course of history within the English political system where for a period of time the Presbyterians ended up taking over or having the predominance within the English Parliament. And so in the course of that, they had requested that the Westminster Assembly advised Parliament on religious matters. And so this assembly went out, commissions, councils, whatever they, groups, study groups, whatever, sent them out. For a number of years, they argued back and forth, a number of scholars, and the product of that was the Westminster Confession. And so the Westminster Confession was to be the confession for the Anglican Church under a Presbyterian style of government. But as it turned out, because of political issues that went on, the Anglican Church never got a chance at the time to take that into their creed, as part of their creed. And the Presbyterians got thrown out of Parliament. They would eventually have some more influence, but not much. In England, they basically lost the kind of power they'd had to produce this Westminster Confession and the catechisms that came along with that, but those lived. Even though the Presbyterian control of England didn't, those documents did, and they became the standards of the English Presbyterian groups. You remember William and Mary? We talked about when William and Mary came along, then the Protestants in general were tolerated a lot more. And as a result, there became almost a reintegration of the Presbyterian ministers back into the Anglican Church and to the Unitarian groups that existed. And so by the end of this 18th century, in England at least, you had very few Presbyterians. There's a third guy we haven't talked about, or third guy, and that's John Knox. And John Knox was a Scotsman, and was a early in his career was a Catholic priest. And a couple years after he became priest, he ended up taking a tutoring assignment for a couple of guys in Scotland that were that resided around the Edinburgh area. Let's just leave it at that. And while he was doing that, there was a fellow that was a Reformation leader by the guy named Weishart, who he became involved with. And Weishart was very active. At the time, Knox wasn't. But he was thoroughly converted over to the Reformed Church, the Reformation theology and faith. And ultimately, this guy Weishart would be martyred. But Knox was actually wanted to go back to Germany and study, become more knowledgeable in the Reformed faith. His employers didn't think too highly of that. And so they sent him with the kids that he was tutoring up to St. Andrews, which is up another, you've heard of St. Andrews, north of way on up north of Edinburgh, to avoid some of the things that were going on around the Edinburgh area in this religious matter. And he spent time there, and while he was there, he ended up doing some preaching, and suddenly he became the spokesman for the Protestant Reformation in Scotland. And he eventually took the view that that was his mission in life. And so he became very active in leading the work in that area. And he would end up being carried off into slavery and then come back to England. And England would, because they were short of ministers, they in the Anglican Church, they got him involved in preaching in the Anglican Church. But he again fled and went up to Scotland again when William Mary came into power. And he took that theology, he still had Calvin's theology, and he took it back to Scotland and was very active in Scotland, established the Presbyterian Church in Scotland as a result. And then with time, the Parliament ended up having a Calvinistic creed, the creed he developed, quickly developed, and that the background, the reason for some of that happening the way it did is tied into the politics. And you'll remember, even today, the Scottish people want to separate themselves from Great Britain. Well, this, you know, this is some of the historical, some of the things that would continue to linger on in the Scottish population were happening. So in any event, he did the creed and their confession of faith. So he was the one who established this stronghold of Presbyterianism in Scotland. So that's sort of the as we've seen time and again, you get the continental, or in this case the islands, the development of the theology, and then it gets somehow moved to the states as a rule, and that's what happens in this case. Y'all are going to need a program for Bung Bung. Worse than watching football teams. I just hope this will make it a little easier to follow. We go through and talk about the churches in the U.S. and ones that how they got to where they are, and these would be and which ones you might run into at least. Both the Presbyterian Church and the Reformed Church of America come out of Europe, of course. And one of them had their roots. The Presbyterian has its roots in Scotland, and the Reformed has its roots in Holland, primarily. And so, if you look on this little chart, you'll see on the left-hand side something called the Dutch Reformed Church. And we'll just look at the Dutch Reformed, and then we'll take a crack at the Presbyterians in a moment. The Dutch Reformed Church had a falling out after it came across and was established in the U.S. in the 1860s, and they had a disagreement within the church over Freemasonry and Christian education and singing hymns. I'm not sure who was on what side of what issue, but not important. And they, as a result of that, they split, and there's now a Christian Reformed Church and a Reformed Church in America, these two branches of this group. They operate from a theology standpoint, they're very similar. From an organizational standpoint, they're very similar. They have something they call classes, which are local congregations are send representatives to these classes, and the classes have elder delegates and pastors from the churches in a given area, and then they have a general synod that is made up of representatives from the individual classes. So it's that same hierarchical structure we've talked about before. They've got these, and I gave you this, confessional statements, the Heidelberg Catechism, the Belgic Confession, the Canons of Dort. The Heidelberg is a one of these liturgical question and answer things that gets repeated every year. So you go through the, it'll last for a year, and then you start back at the front. You do the same thing through it. And they, the Reformed Churches of America that you see in here is the founding member of the National Churches, National Council of Churches, and the World Council of Churches. You may or may not have read about those in the newspaper, or heard of in the news. In fact, several of these, I'll tell you, all of them that are on here, when you get down at the bottom to today, are members of the World Council of Churches, with the exception of the Columbia Presbyterian Church in America, Black. They are not. Both they and the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, neither one of those are members of the World Council of Churches. From the standpoint of the Presbyterian churches, you kind of get to the middle of this group. And you started out with the Colonial Presbyterians in the very top of this thing that got started by largely by the Church of Con members, Scots, Irish, that moved over here and brought this with them. And so this lineage goes back to Scotland, the Colonial Presbyterians. they got into an issue. Remember, we talked about the first and second awakenings, or the Great Awakening, the revival spirit that went on in the United States in the 1800s, 1700s and 1800s. Well, they got into debate within the group as to whether or not that was a appropriate kind of activity. And when you think about them being Calvinistic, you can understand why. And so there became they did a split in 1741. You had a pro-revival group called the New Side Presbyterian and a anti-revival group called the Old Side Presbyterian. And that went on for 15 years or so. And eventually, as these things tend to do, they washed out and events overtook them, and so they ended up rejoining in 1758, called the Presbyterian Church USA. If you follow down, just straight down from that, you'll see that there's another split that occurs in 1837. And that split, as you might imagine, came about because, as we saw in another case, because of the slavery issue. And so you have a northern group, which was the Presbyterian Church of the USA, who's called New School, and another group called Presbyterian Church USA Old School. And they were in disagreement over slavery, among other things. Well, when the Civil War broke out, there was a group that seceded out of the Presbyterian Church USA Old School, and that was the Presbyterian Church of the Confederate States of America. Okay, and so that after the war was over, you have they would not get back together. So you had this northern group, but it took over those who were prepared to follow the new and the old school views. And they joined it in a northern group, and then there was a southern group of new and old school. And so, and what that entails in terms of what was really different in their theology, I doubt you could get a razor blade between them. It had more to do with their culture than anything. And so you have these two groups that would go on. Well, in 1958... let's go over another group, go over another line, and start down that side. You see over on the far right side, Reformed Presbyterian Church, Scott Irish, and this associate seceder Presbyterian Church, both came from Scott-Irish immigration. They would unite in 1782 and become this United Presbyterian Church, generally conservative anti-slavery group. As time went on, they eventually in 58 would join in with merge with the United Presbyterian Church USA. It wasn't until 1983 that the Presbyterian Church US new and old school came back in and formed the final organization at this time of the Presbyterian Church USA. So that's this is the large group of Presbyterians that you're going to run into. In the 1900s, there was another group that broke off, and it broke off because of a doctrine that the mainline Presbyterians were ceasing to hold the idea of inerrancy of the Bible. And so as a result, this group broke off, called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And they would go on, and another year later there would be another group that would break off of that called Bible Presbyterian Church. And the difference between the two of them is one was a little bit more of a fundamentalist than the other one. And so now you've got those two groups. So today there are eight groups of any significance in the Presbyterian church today that carry Presbyterian on their side. And you'll find these to be the, you may find some of these in the course of time. You'll find this one Presbyterian I know. Whether or not you'll find some of these others, I'm not sure. And then the ones that aren't on here are generally smaller. The Presbyterian Church, USA, probably order of magnitude 3 or 4 million people in their membership in the U.S. I don't know. Any of y'all have Presbyterian? No Presbyterian? See if anybody even knows them. I think we get, you know, if you're not a Catholic or Baptist, you're nobody, I guess, cause in this area. It tends to be the case. But you get into the Midwest, and that will change. You get into the Northeast, and that will change. You run into these groups all the time if you're up in that area. Well, I said I was going to get through this. I got through it in no uncertain terms. Let's look at their government for just a minute. And these all share a similar government. That doesn't change. They all share similar doctrines. The government, again, is the presbytery is where they reside. It's hierarchical government they have. And they have their general assembly made up of clergy and lay. And these are legislative and consultative bodies that they have as a general assembly. Their doctrine, with the exclusion of the Cumberland Presbyterian group, which tends to be the more conservative of the bunch, have the basic, I mean, it's not basic, it is, you know, what we've studied for some time now. You know, a lot of it is memorized by now. Straight out of the Westminster Confession of Faith. I've made some quotes here, just to give you a sense of it, that kind of struck me when I read through the confession. On predestination, some men and angels predestinated unto everlasting life, others to death, everlasting death. Well, that's, you know, that's familiar to us. I don't know when we studied if we talked about angels or not, but they, you know, they hold that angels are predestined as well. Depravity, it was kind of interesting on their depravity. Look at the second line. It says, "This their sins God was pleased, according to his wise and holy counsel, to permit, having purposed to order it to his glory." In other words, God wanted Adam and Eve to sin. That was his desire. So, you know, if he wanted Adam and Eve to sin, it makes you wonder, why doesn't he want all people to sin?
That's how they answer the question of, you know, why would God create people just to condemn them to hell? That they would say it's for his glory.
Yeah, for his glory.
So his judgment, he can be glorified in his judgment of the wicked.
Yeah. And I've given you, you know, the verses that are familiar with you, to you. We've covered them several times in different classes that fly in the face of these doctrines. Limited atonement, nothing new there, nor irresistible grace. The elect people saved without obeying the gospel kind of caught my attention. And the first paragraph, last line, says, "So are all other elect persons who are incapable of being outwardly called by the ministry of the word." So I'll read the whole thing. "Elect infants dying in infancy are regenerated and saved by Christ through the Spirit. So are those who are incapable of being outwardly called by the ministry of the word." So you can be saved without obeying the gospel. Fundamental, without doing anything, without, you know, in theory, without having any faith, obviously, because kids. Others not elected, although they may be called by the ministry of the world, and may have some word, and may have some common operation of the Spirit, yet they never fully or truly come to Christ, and therefore cannot be saved. Because this would be an argument, I think, would be used on Simon, talking about Simon. And we talked about that. I mean, the Holy Spirit said he did that which was appropriate to being saved. Preservation of the saints, nothing new there. Sunday is a Christian Sabbath. As you read through that, God hath particularly appointed one day and seven for a Sabbath to be kept holy unto him, which from the beginning of the world, the resurrection of Christ was the last day of the week. And the resurrection of Christ was changed into the first day of the week, which the scripture calls the Lord's Day. Well, I acknowledge the fact that the seventh day was the day of rest and the Sabbath. Where is the Bible ever talking about the Lord's Day being coming the Sabbath? And of course, it doesn't. It's just a jump in logic that's made that is convenient, but can't be shown to be true. Baptism may be pouring. Sprinkling is to be applied to infants. Is not necessary for salvation. And this one, maybe you know, Sam, when you're studying it. It raised the question to me, why in the world baptize an infant if it's not necessary for salvation? What's the point? I mean, the answer is there is no point. And, I think, sometimes I wonder if we get bound up, we can do this, get bound up in tradition. That's what was taught in the past. Nobody takes exception to that. And, there's no basis for that. I put in again the Westminster, I didn't want to inundate you with any more paper than I've given you. But you can see the Westminster Confession. If you look at the Augsburg Confession and look at the titles, they're going to look very much, the appendix, the table of contents are going to look very much alike. They're very similar in their confessions. Okay, that is the Presbyterians and Reformed fast.